Now for a very different alien contact story, which first appeared in the Shared Universe volume, Murasaki. My job in that joint effort was to establish the scene on planet Genji for later authors, since the objective was less to weave a self-contained story than to introduce a world. One result was a gentler tale, less frenetic than the typical space yarn. I rather liked that. Bonding to Genji. It is fundamentally a question of balance, Minoru reminded himself as he left the air flyer and set foot on the island that would be his home for many months. Keeping his stance wide and footsteps close to the ground, he moved cautiously in the insistent, heavy pull of Genji. Balance is vital when exploring a new world, especially when everything was still so new. The flight out from Okuma Base had been all too brief, diving down from trans-Himalayan mountain heights where humans could breathe unassisted, then swooping over a green and red blur of endless fringe-frond forests, then skimming above pale, verdant ocean shallows, and finally alighting on this isolated archipelago where, at last, Minoru would begin work he'd trained for all his life. It was hard to concentrate at such a moment, yet he knew the danger. Excitement was an enemy that could ruin everything with one false step. Careful. You've only been on the ground a few weeks. Even at Okuma Base, they've had a dozen broken limbs. Out here, a fall could kill. During the 10-year journey from Earth, Starship Yamato's drives had been cranked up gradually to 1 1/3 gravities, pre-adapting 300 crew folk to the first alien world visited by humankind. Seldom mentioned during all that time had been the other motive for pushing the engine so hard, to make it first to Murasaki system. Uselessly, it turned out. Yamato arrived after the spacers, upstarts from Earth's asteroid colonies, had already visited the twin worlds of Genji and Chujo, taken samples of alien life, and usurped the privilege of first contact that should have been Japan's. Then, as if shamed by their impertinence, the spacers hadn't even waited to hold conference, but fled earthward on the flimsy excuse that their enviro systems were strained. The letdown told on Yamato's compliment. All that hurrying to get here, then not to be the first to set foot, to plant a flag, or to gaze into strange eyes on a new world? Japan could still claim priority, of course. Its robot probes had discovered this magnificent double planet system, but that wasn't the same. Not the same at all. Encumbered by his pressure suit, Minoru stepped carefully along the blackened trail laid by the lander when it alighted on this loaf-shaped hilltop, hard beside a strange, luminous sea. Behind him, the flyer hissed as it cooled, touched by drifting fingers of sea fog, much thicker than the mountain hazes that shrouded high Okuma Base. It's a whole planet, after all. There are 10 million places, each as different from the rest as Sapporo is from Saipan, each a unique story, and the most familiar-looking will always be utterly alien. The pilot unloaded supplies Minoru and his partner would need during the months ahead. That included, to Minoru's resignation, many kilograms of nutritionally adequate but monotonous algae paste, one more reason to make friends with the natives who were now spilling out of their hilltop hamlets to cross swampy farms on their way toward the landing field. From a distance, they looked like glossy salamanders, slithering along mud-slick trails. This was a tribe already briefly contacted by the spacers, who had catalogued 100 words of local dialect before dashing off. Pausing to catch his breath, he put down his twin satchels and glanced up toward this planet's sister world, little Tonochujo, named after the companion of Great Genji, fabled hero of Japanese children's fables, which filled an entire octant of the sky. Chujo was so close you could make out wispy cloud formations, the dun color of its dry uplands, and the glitter of its midget seas. Here on this part of Genji, where Chujo hovered permanently at the zenith, you could tell time by watching a great curved shadow move across its constant face as the paired planets spun around a common center, their day a composite of their linked momenta. The glow given off by Murasaki's star might be pallid compared with Sol's remembered flame, but it nurtured life on both worlds. And as Knight's Terminator flowed across Chujo's scarred face, it was easy to see why the natives of Genji had never invented clocks. A neat explanation, except it's unusually overcast this close to the sea, and Genjians live nowhere else. Probably much of his life would consist, from now on, of coming up with interesting hypotheses, only to find later evidence that demolished them. On a new world, it wouldn't pay to grow too fond of one's favorite theories, yet another reason to cultivate balance. He heard his partner, Emil Esperanza, approach from behind, breathing hard and carrying more supplies. "Cabron," Emil muttered. "Look at them. They sure seem bigger in real life." Minoru turned. Swiveling too fast in the fierce gravity, he felt a yanking pain as abdominal muscles strained to compensate. After a subjective decade aboard ship, he wasn't the same youngster who once set forth so eagerly for the stars. The weight isn't so bad if you're careful. You can't ever forget, though, not for a minute. And there's the paradox. Who can remember every minute of every day for a lifetime? Long-term effects of the planet's pull could be seen in the thick trunks and low profiles of the nearby trees, clustered in slope-hugging groves. Gravity was also manifest in the squat, wide-limbed gait of the natives, who used paths made of wooden planks to cross paddies and fern-lined fens on their way to the landing site. And yes, they seemed more imposing, more vivid than in those jerky hollows the spacers had shared. The tug of gravity, the cries of a myriad flying creatures, the sluggish shove of heavy, moisture-laden air. Minoru wished he could feel them against his skin, but full environment suits were mandatory until the bioassay was complete, and probably for a long time after that. "I guess they look peaceful enough," Emil added. "Maybe the spacers didn't alienate the locals after all, or infect them." Despite his name, Emil's features were as pure-blooded Japanese as Minoru's, and much more so than the 30 men and women in Yamato's token international contingent. Emil's grandparents had managed a Fujiworks plant in Paraguay, then retired there for the climate, elbow room, and lifestyle. Although the family had kept faith with the purity rules and so maintained Nihonese citizenship, they nevertheless picked up many gaijin ways. Minoru saw with some envy that Emil had taken off his bulky gloves and armlets, sealing his suit above the elbows, but leaving his hands and forearms free to feel wind and air. "I wish I had the nerve." "We still don't know for sure cross-infection isn't possible. There are many similarities between Genjian life and ours." "And even more differences." The other man's voice was rich with Latin accents. "Genji life uses more amino acids than ours because there's less ultraviolet." Emil gestured toward Murasaki's star, which put out just 6/10 of Sol's luminosity. "Any of their pathogens that tried to eat our cells would starve of some necessary ingredient, and our bugs would be poisoned by some chemical never known on Earth." Minoru knew what that implied. If Earth germs found nothing to eat here, what hope had human beings of doing so? He clung obstinately to hope. "There may be something here that's edible." Emil shrugged, as if indifferent. Unlike most of the crew, he showed little frustration at the limited range of ship-grown fare. Emil never speculated, as others did incessantly, what delicacies might be discovered on a new world. "Anyway, none of the spacers came down with weird plagues, and apparently neither did the locals." He gestured toward the Genjians, who had crossed half the distance without apparent hurry, carrying only a few of the tridents locals used as weapon tools. Closer at hand, the natives still looked like fat salamanders, whose long front legs gave them a reared, semi-upright stance. Yet Minoru felt a chill of alienness, for even a salamander had a face. He chided himself. In all honesty, so do these creatures. But such a face, instead of bilateral symmetry, two eyes atop and a mouth below, the Genjians had four bulging vision organs spaced at the corners of a square, centered on impressive gaping jaws. Above, a waving snorkel tube vented the amphibians' excited cries, clearly audible since sound carried well in dense air. Hanging below each Genjian's throat were two slender, tentacle-like hands for fine manipulation. So strange. Yet these were intelligent beings. On this isolated isle, they lived a modest agrarian and fishing existence, tending algal mats and pens of captive, iridescent-finned ichthyoids. But the expedition had spied from space on several cultures possessing metallurgy and even electricity. Anyway, Emil went on, at least the spacers had the sense to make contact on remote locales so any unforeseen infection would be self-limiting. Such courtesy, Minoru said acidly. But Emil seemed genuinely glad. Indeed, I'm grateful the spacers jumped in ahead of us. Now the karma of any harm done rests on their backs, not ours. Emil's blithe attitude was rare among Yamato's crew, most of whom still seethed at the spacer's effrontery. Hissing and rattling, the translator apparatus made a broad range of sounds as Emil tested its sparse store of spacer-donated words, augmented recently by two other Japanese contact teams operating in this archipelago. Theirs wasn't even the primary group opening talks. That, too, lifted some tension. "Hey, you fellas okay now? Do you want me to hang around just in case?" Remembering just in time to move slowly, Minoru turned carefully to look back at the lander where their pilot had finished unloading supplies for their extended stay. "I could help erect your shelter," Don Byrne offered. As one of the few Occidentals on the expedition, his Japanese was thickly accented and much too formal. It made him the butt of jokes by some less tolerant crewfolk. Still, he never seemed to mind, and the cheerful Australian had won Minoru's undying gratitude during the 7th year of the voyage by discovering 3 new recipes for preparing the same old hydroponic ship fare. Still, Minoru wished this assignment had been drawn by a different pilot, Yukiko Arama. There might have been a chance to get a moment alone with her. Ah, karma. Maybe next time. "Not necessary," Emil told the pilot. "You should return to Okuma." Byrne shifted his weight. "Maybe I'll just hang around a while anyway." He began unfolding sections of the storage dome, but Minoru noticed Don never strayed far from his rifle by one leg of the lander. "He's staying to watch over us." To his surprise, Minoru felt no resentment over the presumption, only relief. Emil, on the other hand, sounded irritated. "Well, stay out of the way, and warn us when you're about to take off. We don't want to frighten our hosts." Emil began spreading a tarp, on which he laid objects to help identify the Genjian equivalents of nouns and adjectives toward establishing an orderly dictionary. Minoru opened his own satchel and started doing the same. But as he drew a hammer from the bag, its claw snagged on the material. Caught off balance, he leaned over to compensate. Gravity seized the momentary lapse. Minoru flailed and hit the tarp before he could get his hands out. Impact was sudden, and also harder than instinct led him to expect. The blow stung. Fortunately, despite his brash Gaijin-influenced ways, Emil had the decency not to laugh or even seem to notice. Overcoming embarrassment, Minoru moved with careful deliberation to push back into sitting position. Balance, Minoru thought. I may live the rest of my life on this planet. It certainly isn't going to change to adapt to me. Starship Yamato Crew Database, General News. With establishment phases 1 and 2 accomplished, the following teams are now active. Genji Expedition. Okuma Base on Genji Moonside established atop Mount Korobachi, 6,500 meters altitude. Senior Scientist Matsuhiro Komatsu commanding. 5 domes, 3 landers, 3 power units, 1 computer facility, 1 hydrox fuel processing unit, 1 hydroponics unit, all operational. 2 hydroponics units and 4 planetology laboratories nearing completion. Preliminary survey parties detached to remote islands for early minimum contamination contact sessions. Total crew on Genji, 85 personnel. 19 additional personnel designated for landing upon return of Yamato from Belt Mission. Tonochujo Expedition. Captain Korematsu Tamura has decided to personally lead an expedition to the Lesser World. In addition to archaeological explorations and attempts to make contact with the local inhabitants, this team shall determine feasibility of establishing a hydrogen-oxygen plant at the shore of one of Chujo's small seas. Infrastructure Team. Following Captain Tamura's departure for Chujo, Senior Lieutenant Hideo Ishikawa will take the Yamato plus two scout boats on a brief survey of nearby space in search of candidate small bodies for use in infrastructure manufacturing processes. Casualty figures. Added to the 12 crew mulched or cryo-stored en route, one death at Okuma Base due to a fall, 18 gravity-related injuries. Dr. Komatsu reminds expedition members to practice their drills and observe safety procedures at all times. Minoru slogged through the boggy fields of Green Tower Village, taking samples and supervising as his native assistants labored on a treadmill linked to a scaffold and massive wooden gearing. That clanking, rattling assemblage in turn rotated a machine that projected a cylinder of force into the ground, digging ever deeper into the rich sedimentary layers below. It had taken several days to acquire enough local dialect to get across that humans wanted to hire the natives. But then the Gengians became eager helpers, not only with the coring but scurrying through shallows and across hillsides to snare countless wriggling things, from burrowers to insectoids to flyers with one, two, even three pairs of wings, the first of a multitude of pieces Minoru needed to start putting together a picture of this island's ecosystem. Minoru stank from hour after hour in his biosuit. He itched from low-level rashes as his immune system adapted to new irritants. On two occasions, valuable instruments had broken down, with no way of knowing yet if craftsmen at Okuma Base could repair them or would have to send home for replacements and wait 40 years of real transit time for them to arrive. Yet in all honesty, he could hardly complain. He had impressive tools at his disposal and a Gengian workforce willing to labor long and hard for lumps of iron. Metal was precious on these remote islands where Genji's continental industrial revolution was still but a rumor. Despite temptation, Minoru was careful not to overpay his workers, which would only disrupt their local economy. Anyway, deferred gratification was an important lesson. You learned it early in Japan. Failure to understand the importance of patience and hard work had brought down other great powers that once towered over Minoru's homeland. Now the land of the rising sun stood as the greatest of nations, and its reach extended to faraway stars. The work was going so well, Minoru had even trained some of the smaller male Gengians to dissect and prepare animal specimens, spreading organs and skeletal features under the recording cameras. The natives' coordination with their tiny feeler arms was matched by an ability to bring their eyes exceptionally close, telescoping them to parse minute details. It was a pastime they obviously found amusing. One venerable brood father named Fs-In-Ka seemed fascinated and enthusiastic to learn more. It was Fs-In-Ka who nudged Minoru as the steady drone of the treadmill lulled him. Minoru started at the sudden tug. With their broad peripheral vision, Gengians never seemed to grasp the humans' entreaties not to sneak up on us from behind. "I have brought more samples for study," the translator announced primly, though Minoru thought he understood the hissing trills standing for eye and sample. He saw that Fs-In-Ka had laid a reed mat across the mud, arraying thereon several score tiny animals, all with their necks neatly wrung. "These were gathered within a single patch, 1 meter on a side?" Minoru asked incredulously. Fs-In-Ka made an assent gesture with his snorkel tube. "Yes, the very unknown. You marked off, I made sure to unknown." The last part dissolved in static as the translator tried guessing, then gave up. No matter. This was a new phase. After taking samples randomly all over the island, it was time to start studying in depth. "You sealed off the sample area as I showed you?" "As you showed me, I unknown, down to 1 meter. I am sure nothing unknown escaped, nothing unknown, than the holes in your unknown sieve screen." Minoru peered at the samples. You could learn a lot just by seeing how the Gengian had sorted them, not by size or color, nor apparently by species relatedness. It seemed Fsin Ka had put all the obligate carnivores on one side, all obvious leaf cutters in another corner, and so on. "You are what you eat. I should report this to the xenopsychology group." He made a note to his auto secretary, which beeped acknowledgement. Accomplishing so much so fast meant relying on semi-sentient computer devices to outline, send, and read memos and countless other tasks. "Time to dissect and record?" "Not yet. Let me look over the samples first. Then we'll do a dig together to make sure we haven't missed a trick." Fsin Ka's snorkel waved as he gathered up the samples and the reed mat. "Have we found any unknown yet that the unknown humans can honorably eat?" Minoru started. How did Fsin Ka know? That ulterior motive for Minoru's fevered sampling of flora and fauna went beyond the principal focus of understanding this island's complex ecosystem. Of course, he realized. That would be the first thing to occur to a native. They have no real concept of science, but eating, cooking, the search for something new and good, he probably thinks that's the main purpose of all this collecting. Perhaps this explained why it was males, the gatherers and tenders of the hearths, who were most enthusiastic about helping Minoru, while females preferred a meal with his endless appetite for words. "No, my friend, nothing good to eat yet, but we can still hope." "Hope is unknown. Hope can even be unknown." As Fsin Ka turned and waddled up the path to the science dome, Minoru wondered. That had sounded like an aphorism, a wise saying. It might be a good idea to store it for a meal. "That's enough," he told the workers, turning the corer. The translator barked, and they squatted back, panting. Occasionally, one of them would open its mouth to pick its teeth with one of the slender tentacle arms. Only at times like that was Minoru able to tell for absolute certain which was male and which female. Besides being generally smaller, the males had tongues that were longer and raspier for some reason, ending in a sort of bulbous fixture. Curiously, it did not seem to affect their speech, at least to his untutored ears. The latest core sample came up slickly, a tube of history sheathed in electro-stiffened plastic. His helpers were by now well rehearsed at loading the 5-meter-long tube into the disassembler reader. As the core passed through, layer after sedimentary layer was atomized. A fine dust of ages came out the other end. While all the information formerly locked in ordered patterns of mud and ancient fossils flowed into the capacious computer back at the dome, gradually a database was forming. It would take years, probably decades, to comprehend more than a cursory view of life on Genji, its complex chemistry and interlaced ecologies. Still, some pieces were already falling into place. For one thing, life here was as old as on Earth. Evolution had progressed at a similar pace, despite less radiation-induced mutation. Instead, a built-in diversity driver came from half a dozen extra amino acids in the protein code. The grinding mill of Darwinism had more to work with, producing a profusion of winners and losers to make a broad-branched tree of life, broader than Earth's. With fewer comets, Murasaki's system had fewer big impacts to shake up Genji's biosphere. Few mass extinctions meant many ancient families and phyla still co-inhabited the planet. It was as if some of the wild experiments tried on Earth during the Precambrian, recorded in half-billion-year-old formations like the Burgess Shale, had never died out, but instead gone on to share the seas with shark and squid and whales. In addition to creatures built as segmented tubes, like Fsin Ka's people and all metazoans on Earth, there were also branches which grew as flat sheets or radial stems. Orbital scans showed creatures so eerie that Gengians themselves could be thought almost human. One of Minoru's workers performed something akin to a gaping yawn, and Minoru blinked, stepping backward in surprise. Apparently, the other natives were as shocked by the gesture. Several hissed, and one even tried to nip the offender's tail. She snarled back. Then abruptly, the altercation was forgotten. Almost as one, the natives lifted their heads and turned. Minoru carefully followed, and saw a darkness rapidly approach from the east. The deck of low-lying clouds dimmed along a sharp border that neared rapidly, casting a moving shadow across the hillsides and the fog-draped sea. A low moan rose from the Gengians as they reared to gape in the direction of Chujo, even though the sister world was covered by clouds. The shadow rushed over them, and translucent sunlight faded by half as Genji's twin world passed in front of Murasaki's star, commencing the noon eclipse. Time to down tools. For this culture, on this archipelago, it was a holy interval lasting about 20 minutes, during which one might speak or rest, but never work or fight. Minoru took what he hoped the natives considered a stance of respect. After all, on shipboard, and even in their tiny habitation domes, many human crew folk kept little Shinto, Buddhist, Christian, or Gaian shrines. He was proud of the Japanese attitude toward religion, which said essentially, whatever works. As soon as the Genjian's keening song of greeting was finished, one of the largest females approached Minoru in a slow, tail-swishing undulation. He recognized Ta Ajda by several scars along her left flank, which she had told Emile she'd acquired in a raid by another village during her youth on another island. Females were the wanderers and warriors in this species, a fact that still had sociobiologists at Okuma Base puzzled, but Minoru thought he was beginning to understand why. "You, unknown, our rights of, unknown and shadow," the translator said, struggling with her words. It had more trouble with some topics than others. "If we are, unknown, will you convey our, unknown, to, unknown?" "I'm sorry, I..." Minoru gave up. "Connect to Emile," he said, and almost without pause, his partner's face lit up the left quadrant of his visor. "Minoru, I'm kind of busy." Minoru could see three of Emile's language helpers squatting in the shirt-sleeve environment of the halfway dome, set to an atmospheric pressure midway between sea level and what was comfortable for humans. Emile's skin pallor didn't look good, and his eyes were droopy, but at least he didn't have to wear a stinking suit all the time. Minoru envied him. "Just a quick one. Give me a read on this, will you?" And Minoru squirted over to Hajda's question. Emile puzzled for a moment, then he laughed. "Oh, she's just asking to hitch a ride to Chujo." "To Chujo?" Emile lifted one eyebrow. "You hadn't heard? It seems according to their mythology, Chujo is the home of the angels. Many of them think that's where we came from." "No wonder they're so cooperative. But what will happen when they find out?" "Relax, there's no religious hysteria about it, at least not among this group, though the boys over at Purple Cliffs Island seem to have had a rough moment when the truth came out. Anyway, I've already explained the situation to several of their traveling monks or rabbis or holy whatevers. And say, did you know they're nearly all females? Anyway, I told them we're not from Chujo, but another star. They don't seem to mind. Here, let me give you a nice soothing diplomatic answer for Ta Ajda." Emile muttered a command, and Minoru's translator conveyed a string of Genjian words directly from his helmet speaker. Ta Ajda took a couple of steps back at one point, then rocked her head in an expression Minoru thought might mean perplexity. At last, she seemed satisfied, or at least turned and wandered away. Emile's picture disappeared without a sign-off, and Minoru tried not to be offended. He himself must sound just as curt when experts from other teams called him, demanding quick biological answers while he was still flailing around looking for the big picture. Sometimes, indeed, it all seemed almost too much, and he longed for crowded, comfortable Osaka back home on Earth. "I'm doing my life's work," Minoru recalled at those moments. "No one could be happier." That was true as far as it went. Only occasionally, Minoru wished he were a different sort of person altogether, one born with simpler tastes and more mundane interests, who was not the type to volunteer at age 15 to be sent hurtling toward a heavy, sweaty world. Weren't there less exhausting roads to happiness? Alas, those roads were not in his dharma to tread. Genji Expedition Database, Summary on Genjian Sapience, by Shige Owari, Chief Xenologist. The intelligent beings we call Genjians bear some resemblance to Earth's amphibian life forms. Such comparisons can be misleading, however, since there is nothing at all primitive about this planet's autochthons. It is true that they have not spread to as many ecological niches as humans had at similar levels of technological development. By the Iron Age, human beings occupied even mountaintops and Arctic wastes, while the natives of this world seem almost exclusively to inhabit coastlines and alluvial basins. Nevertheless, it should be noted that in all other indicators we seem to have met peers. Preliminary studies by Komiko Takeshita reveal an emotional range as vivid and finely textured as our own. Komiko's preliminary intelligence profiles demonstrate considerable overlap in cognitive ability with pre-computer human societies. The linguistic group has decided to adopt as generic the species self-name used in this archipelago by the Etakthons. In future documents, therefore, sentient Gengians shall be referred to as Irdizu. This has been deemed acceptable by natives at all contact sites. Their strong tails with two horizontal flukes appear to propel the torpedo-shaped Irdizu efficiently through the water. On shore, they use their tails for support and to assist locomotion. The heavily muscled appendages also serve as formidable weapons. Another word for balance was equilibrium. Minoru contemplated this as he sat naked under a sun lamp in Padmasama position on a reed mat donated by the village elders. The little habitation dome hissed as it fed the produce of his respiration and his previous meals into wall panels that used sunlight and algae to recycle human wastes. At the output end, there accumulated an all-too-familiar green paste that, despite its blandness, would keep his body going, enabling him and Emil to extend their visit here at least several months. The dome recycler seemed a perfect example. At first sight, it appeared to be a balanced system. But it wasn't in equilibrium, not really. The pallid glow of Murasaki's star was barely adequate to drive the process. Anyway, at best, the return was less than 30% efficient. Minoru often dreamt he was back aboard the Yamato, where, despite the ennui of 10 years' subsistence on hydroponics, there was at least some variety. Once a month, a chef would prepare delicacies from that exclusive locked chamber where fish were kept in special tanks, and licentious amounts of power and resources were spent nurturing rare herbs. Tomorrow, the supply plane was due with provisions for the two of them. If it failed to arrive, the clever recycler would keep Minoru and Emil alive for some time. But without replenishment, they would waste away on a diet of ever-declining value. There was a parallel in his mission here, which was only partly to help Emil and other xenology teams make friends with the Irdizu. Over the months and years ahead, Minoru's principal job would be to find out what kept this world from toppling over to catastrophe. Catastrophe such as we experienced on Earth, he thought. Only in his parents' lifetime had a chain of ecological crises abated enough for nations to contemplate deep exploration again. Although heroic intervention had finally stopped the spreading deserts, Minoru knew those rosy-eyed propagandists in the press were wrong. Earth would never be just as good as before. The timer on the sun lamp rattled to a stop, and the warm glow tapered. These daily sessions were necessary to stave off sunlight deficiency disorder, but they also reinforced his sense of being on an alien world. Nor was this a shiny day, even for Genji. Wrapping a robe around himself, Minoru went to the east-facing window and watched high tide finish inundating the natives' broad expanse of trapping ponds, depositing the sea's bounty to be left high and dry when the waters receded again. Tending these basins took up half the labor force, and their ownership was subject to fierce inheritance rules, sometimes enforced by nasty local feuds. Minoru went to the computer deck and surveyed his latest composite of this island's biological history. Slowly, out of his deep cores and animal dissections, a picture was resolving. The family tree of local species was just 2% filled in, yet a shape was taking form, and he was beginning to suspect all was not as it appeared on Genji. My supervisor won't like this report, he thought, popping a memory cube with his monograph on it to be sent back to Okuma Base. Nevertheless, he looked forward to tomorrow's lander. Yukiko might be the pilot. If only I had something to offer her. Starship Yamato Crew Database, General News. Genji Expedition. With deployment of the big antenna in high orbit, a report has been prepared for beaming back to Earth. Unlike prior data clusters, this one shall be designed specifically for public consumption. It has been decided to focus this first show on the harmonious, cooperative nature of Irdizu society. Although violence does play a small role in life among the inhabitants, their traditions of serenity appear to have much in common with those that we have managed to maintain in Japanese society. The value of this message to the people of Earth as a whole should be exemplary. Chief Ecologist Seigi Sato reports, "This solar system is a less dynamic place than our own, less subject to stellar perturbations or asteroidal impacts. In this more stable environment, which has not gone through the frequent fluctuations of our home system, we find none of the signs of spreading wasteland which have inflicted so much pain at home. From orbit, we see clear evidence that the Irdizu have been industrialized in some locales for much longer periods than humans were on Earth, although at a lower technological level. Yet they appear to live without significant environmental degradation, such as erosion or desertification. I am now convinced we have found here proof of what Japan has contended all along, that the environmental disturbances suffered by Earth during recent generations were the product of natural forces and not the result of so-called human mistreatment of our home world. For astronomical reasons, Genji is a luckier world than Earth. It is as simple as that." Dust rose around the jet outlets of the lander as its engines turned on idle. Near the ramp, Emil Esperanza went over an inventory list next to a stack of fresh supplies, while Minoru escorted the pilot back to her craft. At the bottom of the ramp, he handed her the data cube containing his report, which she pushed into a pocket of her provocatively snug pressure suit. "You're sure you can't stay?" he asked Yukiko, unable to keep disappointment out of his voice. She shook her head. "I can't, Minoru-san. I promised to drop in at Purple Cliffs Station for dinner." With a light in her eyes, she leaned toward him and whispered, "They say they found a local berry with low toxicity levels and what they call a tart but pleasant taste." "Lucky bastards," Minoru commented, meaning the remark more ways than one. He knew full well what Todo and Shimura were trying to accomplish by inviting Yukiko to a feast. She smiled. Dimples under her brown eyes made him want to reach out and touch her smooth skin. Only propriety and her helmet faceplate prevented him. "I'll let you know how it tastes, Minoru," Yukiko said. "If it's any good, I'll bring you some next time I drop by." "Just so," Minoru looked away. He sometimes wished this expedition had been run in a somewhat less Japanese way. On the trip out, there might have been more liberal sexuality as practiced by the spacers. But the Japanese response to intense pressures, especially those of long, confined spaceflight, was instead to tighten social strictures. For unmarried women, chastity had been the rule for 10 time-dilated years. Now that they had landed, though, something had changed in the social climate. Soon, larger living quarters would be available in the high altiplano freshness of Okuma Base, room for new couples to set up house and even start families. He and Yukiko, like many others, had set out from Earth as teenagers, yet he was still looked on as an awkward youth, while she was considered the most beautiful and desirable woman among those left unattached. Clearly, she was in the process of looking, sampling, making up her mind. Underneath his outwardly impassive shell, Minoru felt helpless and, to a growing degree, desperate. "Oh, I almost forgot," Yukiko said, turning at the top of the ramp. She reached inside the ship and brought down a slim lacquered box crafted delicately out of hardwood. This she handed to Minoru. "A present, since you missed the cooking at Okuma." Under the wood veneer, a cooling unit purred delicately. His mouth watered. "Is it?" "Sushi, yes. Cultured hamachi and uni. I hope you like it." Her smile filled Minoru with wonder, encouraging imagined possibilities he had all but given up. "Will I see you again soon?" "Maybe." Then impulsively, she touched her helmet to his for an instant. "Take care." Soon the lander rose on its column of heated steam, watched by a crowd of Irduzu gaping from behind a safety line scratched in the sand. Minoru watched the flying machine peel away and followed it across the sky until it disappeared. Then he went to help Emil move the supplies. "You've got hopes," Emil commented succinctly, perhaps dubiously. "Come on," Minoru grumbled. "I still have the east slope cliffs to cover before nightfall, and haven't you got work to do, too?" He hoisted a crate that should have called for two in this gravity and moved awkwardly but happily toward the storage dome, away from Emil's knowing smile. The laser played across the cliff face in double waves. First, a gentle scan lit every millimeter of the sheer sedimentary surface, while recording devices read its reflections, noting every microscopic contour and color variation. Then the machine sent forth a much more powerful second beam, which seared away a thin layer. Monitors recorded glowing spectra from these vapors, taking down elemental compositions in minute detail. Minoru always made certain few Irduzu were present to watch this process. He didn't want superstitious awe of humans spreading even faster. A certain amount meant he and Emil were probably safe from receiving the pointy end of a trident in some future labor management dispute. On the other hand, he had no wish to be mistaken for a god. "Perhaps I'd have been more tempted were the natives more attractive," Minoru admitted wryly. Adolescence was not so long past that he didn't recall those dreams of old. The comic books he used to read in Japan had been filled with seraglios and other imaginative scenarios to titillate teenagers and suppressed businessmen alike. Even on shipboard, especially on shipboard, fantasy had been a way to swim against the tide of ennui. He recalled one mural painted on the lower decks by some frustrated engineers, which depicted green-skinned but nubile alien beauties catering to the desires of noble earthling demigods. Even aboard the Yamato, Minoru had thought the notion childish and unlikely given reports on Genji from the robot probe. Now all that seemed long ago and far away. All he could conjure in his mind was one face, one person. He wished his job didn't force him to spend so much time exploring sterile cliffs, when what he really needed to impress Yukiko might be waiting right now in some nearby meadow, in some underground burrow, or in some tidal shoal. "Well, at least Fsinkai's out there looking on my behalf. He knows the local flora and fauna better than I do. I'm sure he'll come up with something." Minoru brought his attention back to business at hand. What grew in the computer display was a slice-by-thin-slice representation of the cliff. Each horizontal lamina layer had been laid down along this ancient coast long ago, when the vagaries of this slowly shifting archipelago pushed lapping tidal waters over the place where he now stood. Amid the slowly growing image in his holoscreen lay speckles of bright color where the device found fossil outlines, remains of creatures that had settled into the mud long ago. Playing with the controls, Minoru zoomed among these discoveries, linking and correlating each one with his database of currently living animal types. Tentative identifications were made in real time by phylum, family, genus, sometimes even by species. What emerged was a picture that would eventually tell the story of life on Genji. As on Earth, the epic had begun at sea. Quite early, some Genjian life form discovered a chemical similar to chlorophyll that it used with sunlight to split water, manufacturing its own carbohydrates and proteins, spilling a corrosive waste product, oxygen, into the atmosphere. Soon, as on Earth, Genji's early citizens had to adapt to changing conditions or die. Eventually, they not only adapted, but learned to thrive on the stuff. Higher energy chemistry enabled faster, more complex modes of living. Over the course of time, some single-celled animals fell on the knack of combining and sharing roles, just as the eukaryotes did on Earth about 700 million years before Minoru was born. Amazing similarities, amazing differences. As the cliff face slowly dissolved back micron by micron, by a total thickness amounting to no more than the erosion of a typical rainy season, Minoru fell into a zen-like work trance, absorbed by the story unfolding before his eyes. His hands flew across the controls, eyes darting from discovery to discovery. In his youth, he had pictured exploring alien worlds as a matter of striding forth, ray gun in hand to rescue and be rewarded by alien maidens. He had seen himself the bold hero of space battles, planting flags and beating off hordes of slathering monsters to uphold the right. This was a better way. The fantasies of childhood were vivid, barbaric. Minoru recalled them with affection. But all in all, he much preferred being grown up. More transients had arrived to set up camp in the shanty town over by the funnelweed swamp. They were young adult females mostly, just past first blush, and into their wandering home-finding phase. They had been drifting in for weeks from distant parts of the island, and even nearby isles attracted by a sudden wealth of circulating metal. The newcomers' shelters were rude makeshift affairs built on high stilts to keep just above the average daily tides. The hovels lay in the shadow of finely carved and dressed hilltop farmsteads. Established villagers glared down, sharpening decorative wooden stakes in close rows around their family compounds. Guards were posted to prevent pilfering from the Terran domes when Minoru and Emil were away. Recently, there had been incidents between locals and newcomers in the village common areas. Scrapes and jostlings for the few jobs on Minoru's work crews, for instance. Tail blows were exchanged as young females preened and competed for the attention of bewildered local bachelors. Yesterday, at Minoru's urging, Emil took a break from interviewing his coterie of wise women and began questioning the transients instead. On his return, the young linguist expressed dismay. "We've disrupted the economy of the entire island. Everything is in an uproar, and it's all because of us." Minoru hadn't been surprised. "That's one reason contact teams were spread out, to lessen the impact. Anyway, what you're seeing is just an exaggeration of what went on all the time, even before we came." "But the fighting, the violence." "You've been listening to Dr. Sato's romantic notions about our peaceful Irdizu friends who don't even know the meaning of war. Well, that's true up to a point, but don't you ever listen to the folk tales you recorded? How about the story of Rishongnu and the town that refused? I remember it's a morality tale about the importance of hospitality." Minoru interrupted, laughing. "Oh, it's much simpler than that. Rishongnu really existed, did you know that? And the village she conquered did not burn once, but at least 40 times over centuries both before and after her adventure." Emil blinked. "How do you know?" "Simple archaeology. I've taken cores of the site where Rishongnu supposedly lived and found carbon layers that give very specific dates for each rise and fall. Anyway, it makes perfect sense. These beings exercise female mobile exogamy and polyandry based on male-intensive nesting. It's not like anything seen among mammals on Earth, but the pattern's pretty familiar among some types of birds and amphibians. Young females must set out and win a place in the world, and find one or more husbands to take primary care of offspring. She does this either by wooing a mate from a strong, well-established line, or by pioneering new territory, or by taking a place from someone else." "You make it sound so savage." Minoru shook his head. "It's right and proper to admire nature, Emil, but never to idealize it. The process is a competitive one, always has been, in every species known. For instance, it didn't take long to confirm that the most basic rule of biology applies just as universally here on Genji. It was known even before Darwin, and it goes like this. In all species, the average breeding pair tries to have more offspring than needed to replace themselves." Emil frowned. "But then what keeps animals from overpopulating?" "Good question. The answer is natural controls. Predation by carnivores higher on the food chain, or competition for limited food and shelter. I know it doesn't sound nice, it's just nature's way. But humans, yes, we're an exception. We learn to control our numbers voluntarily, but after how long a struggle, and at what price? I assure you, no other earthly species even makes the effort. So it's only natural I was curious about the sentient creatures we found here," Minoru went on. "I don't know about the Chujo natives yet, Who does? But on Genji, I set out to learn. Did the rule hold here as well? That's why I asked you to inquire about their use of birth control. They do have some means, Emile said eagerly. Yes, but practiced sporadically. So the question remains, what else controls the Irdizu population? Emile looked at Minoru glumly. I suppose you're going to tell me. Minoru shrugged. It seems a little of everything is involved. Some deliberate birth control, to be sure. Some predation by sea carnivores when they forage too far. There is definitely some loss attributable to internecine fighting over the better fens, farmlands, and housing sites. At intervals, there has been starvation. Finally, there's the environment. How do you mean? Emile asked. Have you noticed the way Irdizu houses are shaped like boats, even though they're built mostly on hilltops? Of course, it's a holdover from their ancestor legends when they were seafaring. Emile trailed off when Minoru shook his head. No. I'm afraid they build them that way for much less romantic, more pragmatic reasons, because every once in a while the tides sweep that high. Emile gasped at the mental image, but Minoru went on. That's why the shanty town looks out of place. On Earth, slums played long-lasting roles in community life. Here, such areas are at best temporary. For the newcomers, it's win a place on high ground or die. Emile simultaneously muttered a Buddhist prayer and crossed himself in the Latin manner. No wonder the level of tension is rising so. No wonder. Obviously, you and I must leave soon. But you said this sort of thing was going on anyway, even without our presence. But we're setting off a local intensification, Minoru said. I don't want the consequences on my karma. Besides, conditions here are no longer natural. We must try to finish soon before there's nothing here to learn anymore. Starship Yamato Crew Database, General News. Infrastructure Expedition. Senior Lieutenant Hideo Ishikawa reports that smelting has begun on asteroid M27852. It is hoped that within 3 months we may be able to establish a Phase 1 solar array in orbit above the combined Genji-Chūjō epicenter. Even at best, however, it will take several years to create enough infrastructure to be certain of human survival in this alien system. A picture was starting to form. From surveying sediments, the island's flora and fauna, and the natives' own legends, Minoru was beginning to see an outline of Genji's recent past. He hadn't told even Emile about what happened when the ancestors of Tazajda and Fsinka arrived on this isle 80 or so Irdizu generations ago. The paleontological record was clear, though. Within 4 of those generations, half of the species native to this isolated ecosphere had gone extinct or were driven across the waters. This was no intentional genocide. Human migrants had done the same thing just as inadvertently back on ancient Earth, as on Hawaii, where countless bird species vanished soon after men and women arrived by Polynesian canoe. More harm was done by creatures arriving with men, rats and dogs and pigs, than by human hunters. On Genji, the history of die-offs was clear in layers of soil and rock. Fsinka and other bright Irdizu had been astonished when Minoru gave them lessons how to read that record, a long list of animals and plants that weren't around anymore. But that wasn't the biggest surprise. Not by far. Starship Yamato Crew Database, General News. Genji Expedition. One of the most curious things about our discovery of Genji is the incredible temporal coincidence that we should have happened upon this world at the very time when mainland cultures are amidst their burgeoning industrial revolution, spreading both physically and in their confident grasp of their technology. What a fluke of timing. Consider, had we on Earth been slower, and the Irdizu faster by a mere millennium, a mere flicker as time goes by in this vast galaxy, it might have been they who discovered us. Let this realization teach us humility as we seek to learn from our new neighbors. She stepped down the lander's ramp with a grace that was pleasurable to watch. It was so much like the way she flew machines across the sky, somehow both demure and erotic at the same time. He doubted any Occidental woman could match it. Minoru's heart was pounding, nevertheless. He kept his greeting properly reserved. They exchanged bows. To his delight, he saw she carried an overnight bag. "So, what is this surprise you promised me?" Yukiko asked. Did something in her voice imply possibilities? Ah, but what are possibilities? To become real, they must be earned. "You'll see," he told her, and gestured toward the village where smoke curled up from smoldering cook fires. "This way, unless you want to freshen up first," she laughed. "Wriggling out of this suit so soon after I just put it on? No, I freshened in the lander. Come on, I'm hungry." So she's guessed what this is about. Minoru was only slightly disappointed. After all, her insight showed an aspect of compatibility. They thought alike. Or at least we share one obsession. It hardly seemed intimate walking slowly side by side in clunking, ground-hugging steps, carefully maintaining balance on the sloping path. Gravity was like a treacherous octopus, always waiting to grab you. Swaddled inside their suits, even with their arms and lower legs now free by decree of Okuma-based doctors, it felt as if they were performing a long, slow promenade. Minoru hoped to dance a different dance with Yukiko later, one in which gravity would play a friendlier role, but he kept a tight rein on such thoughts. "Where is Emil?" she asked as they approached the plateau where village center lay. "He's observing an Irdizu folk moot over there in the civic arena." Minoru gestured toward where several close hills formed a bowl, from which the low hum of voices could be heard rising and falling in a moaning melody. Minoru had witnessed moots before, though none this large. They struck him as somewhat like a Greek play, with chorus, actors and all, crossed with no theater, and interrupted at odd moments by bouts of activity reminiscent of sumo wrestling. Emil persuaded the village mothers to hold a special event for the transients, to relieve tensions and maybe give them a stake in the community.
Sounds pretty daring, an alien making suggestions like that.
Minoru shrugged. Well, we had to try something. The poor kid was racked with guilt, even though the situation isn't really our fault. Anyway, it seems to be working. I'd have been expected to attend also as an honored guest, only I am one of the cooks for the feast afterward, so I'm excused.
Ah, so,
she said it calmly, but had he picked up just a trace of excitement in her voice? Minoru hoped so.
Fsinka had been tending to the preliminaries for Minoru, carefully removing the external carapaces of 30 recently snared inch-long zuunutsus, and one by one laying the nude insectoids on a wooden cutting board near the cooking fire. Before being cut up, the zuunutsus looked like earth caterpillars and fit a similar niche in this ecosystem, though nowadays they were very rare.
"Thank you," he told his assistant, and then explained to Yukiko. "In my routine bioassay, I finally struck it rich. Two plants and this insectoid, all of whom practice chemical segregation of just the kind we need."
"What does that mean?"
"It means that in all three cases, every chemical that might be toxic to humans happens to be segregated, isolated to specific parts or organs. A lot better than those berries the Purple Cliffs team fed you."
Yukiko frowned. "I was ill for a week."
"Which were considered edible only because the poison levels were tolerable. In this case, all you have to do is carefully remove the bad parts."
With a dissecting scalpel, he deftly excised portions that served functions similar to kidneys and livers for the zuunutsus, flicking them in high arcs to sizzle on the coals. "You might say it's like preparing fugu back home."
"Really?"
she gasped, grabbing his arm tightly through the suit fabric.
"You devil, you!"
Yukiko seemed impressed, thrilled when he compared his find to Oriental blowfish, considered one of Japan's paramount delicacies. Fugu chefs were respected more than surgeons, although mistakes still killed hundreds of customers each year. Indeed, risk seemed to be part of the excitement. Minoru had been about to assure her with his precautions, but Yukiko's expression stopped him. From the look in her eyes, either she had great faith in him, or this was a girl who relished a thrill. Both, I hope. Even after all of his careful chemical examinations and the joyful discovery of something edible out of the countless field samples,
It had still taken considerable trial and error to reach this point. The recipe had come about after many trials, of which the last involved both himself and Emil as guinea pigs. Nevertheless, the culmination had been saved for tonight. It was to be the first complete, all-Gengian meal ever served for humans. That is, if all went as planned. Carefully, he slit open several Yurtani roots and slipped the flayed fillets of Zuunutsus inside, along with chopped Kienmathi. They should bake for an hour, he said, wrapping each combination in funnelweed fronds and putting them directly on the coals. Why don't we go for a walk in the meantime? The other cooks, most of them males with infants riding on their tails, hissed amiably as Minoru led Yukiko toward a steep embankment overlooking the tidal basins. There the two humans sat down, dangling their legs over a stone wall, looking up as clouds parted to show the desert brown face of Chujo. It was eerie to realize that up there, right now, some of their crewmates were attempting to make contact with aliens even more enigmatic than the Irdizu.
You know, your latest report almost got you recalled to Okuma Base, she told him as she watched sparse clouds lay shadows across the sister world.
I know. How is Dr. Sato taking it?
He's hopping mad. And Dr. Leary feels hurt you made these revelations without consulting him first.
That might have gotten my report buried in the database. This is something that must be known by all, before we decide how we are going to make our homes on this world.
Our principal purpose is study.
Indeed, but we'll also live as men and women, have homes, perhaps children. We should know the implications and not take steps unconsidered, like animals. She looked at him, obviously feeling his intensity. Minoru sensed somehow that she approved.
Tell me about the cycles, then, she asked.
Minoru sighed. He had gone through it all so many times, first over and over in his head and in the database, then in his report, and finally in interviews for the Team Yamato News. But this audience could be refused nothing. There is no coincidence, he began, or at least it's not as great a coincidence as Dr. Sato thought. It's still surprising that two stars as near each other as Sol and Murasaki developed technological cultures so close in time. But we did not just happen on Genji's solitary industrial revolution. It's occurred on this planet before, at least 6 or 7 times. From a pouch, he drew a corroded lump of metal. This coin or medallion was found locally, only a little ways down, but no native can identify the writing. I doubt they'll be able to on the mainland either. The present culture settled this island 80 generations ago. Before that, it was deserted. But earlier still, other Irdizu lived here. Those occupations came in multiple waves, and several times they had metallurgy.
Was each fall because of war? Yukiko asked in a hushed voice.
Who can say? Oh, there's no sign of nuclear combat, if that's what you mean. No war-induced endless winter. You might think there was such a holocaust, though, from the way the species died out in waves, then recovered after Irdizu receded again, and every decline seemed to occur at the same pace as environmental degradation.
No wonder Dr. Sato's mad at you. You agree with the Americans and spacers that technology can harm a world, Minoru shrugged.
There was a time when that was the main dogma of ecology. Perhaps we abandoned such a view too quickly, for reasons more political than scientific.
I don't know what you mean.
No matter, he shook his head. Anyway, the Gengians appear to have been lucky. One of the limitations of their race actually led to its survival. Since they were and are constrained to living near the shore, none of their past civilizations did much harm to the interiors of the continents. Those in the great ocean served as genetic reservoirs, so that each time Irdizu's civilization fell and the natives' numbers plummeted, there were lots of species that could drift into the emptied niches and fill them again. In fact, it's rather startling how quick some recovery times were, as little as 10,000 years in one case.
Yukiko frowned. I'm beginning to see what you mean. Back at Okuma Base, engineers talk about advantages we can offer the Irdizu. With the right tools, they could exploit much more territory.
Then she blinked.
Oh, and we humans will make our homes in the highlands, where we can breathe without machines. But anything we do up there will affect whole watersheds.
Minoru shrugged. Just so. They sat in silence. Minoru regretted having spoiled the mood and was at a loss how to recover their previous high spirits. Idiot, he thought. Can't you ever leave business at the shop? But he shouldn't have worried. Yukiko nudged him.
Well, we humans haven't done any harm yet, have we? Never borrow karma from next week, I always say.
He grinned in response. A wise woman is a treasure beyond price.
And it's a wise man who realizes what outlasts beauty,
she answered his smile.
So it should be almost time now, yes? Let's eat.
The moot was still in its last phases when they returned to the cook area, but stragglers were already slithering into the clearing to line up in winding queues with clay and wicker utensils. Newcomer females mixed with the locals with apparent conviviality, and Minoru could tell Emile's plan must have worked. For now, at least, all thought of strife had been put aside. He fished the zuunutsus from the coals and gingerly unwrapped the steaming leaves. Balancing their meals on native crockery, he and Yukiko claimed jars of a yeasty native brew that had been deemed only marginally poisonous by Okuma-based doctors, no more dangerous than some of the concoctions whipped up aboard the Yamato during the long voyage out. When Yukiko inhaled the aroma, then bit into her first roll, the expression on her face was Minoru's reward. Tears streamed down her cheeks, and he heard a soft sob of joy. The ridiculousness of such emotion, to be spent on a mere meal, did not escape her, and she burst out laughing, demurely hiding her mouth behind one hand. Minoru, too, alternately laughed and cried as he savored the rich, delicious flavors. Together, silently, they ate and watched Murasaki's star settle toward the horizon, igniting the western cloud banks with streamers of golden fire. At last, wiping his mouth through his helmet's chow baffle, Minoru commented, "Stupid spacers. They hurried home with a few chemical samples to patent and sell. So what? If they'd stayed another few months, we could have sent zuunutsus home with them. And we'd all be rich, spacer and Yamato crew alike."
"I'm just as glad that never happened," Yukiko sighed. "For the first time, I think I can picture this as my home. I don't even want to share this with Earthlings."
Then she grinned at the irony of her remark. It felt good, stretched out in the twilight, laughing together, and sharing the very first moment two humans drew a full measure of sustenance from Genji, and only Genji. "Of course we'll have to plant Earth crops on the highlands and make orbital farms and other things, but it's good to know we can partake of this world too, if we just search long and hard enough." She agreed in silence, but set his heart beating faster by slipping her hand into his. The noisy clamor of Irdizu banqueting rose behind them, followed by a round of their strange atonal singing. Minoru and Yukiko lay contentedly, watching Chūjō head slowly from crescent to quarter phase. They barely turned to look when Fsunka waddled up to ask if there was anything more Minoru needed. It seemed several of the newcomer females wanted to serenade Fsunka tonight, and he had gotten a babysitter for the kids. "No, I don't need anything more. You've already earned a bonus today," Minoru assured Fsunka. "Tomorrow, though, I want to get together some of our best foragers and go after some more zuunutsus. We must learn how to breed them in captivity. Send samples to Okuma Base." Minoru was already thinking how well this might serve as a peace offering to Dr. Sato, and so he rambled on for a while before noticing the stance of the Irdizu male, whose snorkel drooped disconsolately. "What's the matter?" Minoru asked through the translator.
"No more zuunutsus. All unknown. This was the unknown." Yukiko gasped. But Minoru squeezed her hand and laughed, a little nervously.
"Oh, come on, I know they weren't plentiful, but surely there must be some hives left in the hills, or on other islands," he asked hoarsely. His voice trailed off as he wished he did not know this Genjian so well, or that Fsunka weren't so well known for utter reliability and truthfulness. That is where we had to go to find these, Fsinka answered simply.
But, Minoru swallowed, are you absolutely sure?
Fsinka whirled his snorkel clockwise. All the best, unknown foragers took part. We knew it would bond you to us, if only you could, unknown, eat of Genji. So we made a vow of, unknown, we did not fail. Now it is done.
Minoru sat back against the stone wall with a sigh. This was a blow. It was inconceivable. It was...
Yukiko suddenly giggled, and Minoru could not prevent a flicker of a smile from twitching the corner of his mouth. It was horribly hilarious. He laughed, saw shared understanding in Yukiko's eyes, and broke up, shaking with guffaws. Of course, he realized as his sides began to hurt. It had to be this way. In order to make this our home, we must do more than partake of its substance. We must also share its karma. And what better way to do that than to sacrifice the one thing on Genji we might have come to treasure above all others? Above, may the gods forgive us, even the Irdizu. What better way to demonstrate what we have to lose?
Oh, he would do his best to persuade his fellow colonists to establish rules, traditions that would keep the Earthling's share of ecological shame to a minimum. Perhaps they might even help the Irdizu escape the cyclic trap that seemed to have kept them ensnared for so long. On the other hand, perhaps humans would prove a bane to this world, helping the Genjians complete a job of destruction their own limitations had prevented them from ever finishing before. He would fight to prevent that, but who could predict the future? All of that lies ahead, Minoru thought. All that and much more. For well or ill, we are part of this world now. Fsinka was right. This is now our home. Yukiko held up the last pair of Zuunutsu rolls, now cold, but still aromatic with a flavor to make the eyes water with delight and irony.
One we save for Emil, of course. Shall we seal and refrigerate the other one for Sato?
He took the tender object from her, tore off a morsel, and tossed it into the bay far below. She met his eyes and reached out to do the same. Then, with his free hand, he helped her stand.
Let's save it all right, he said, but for a special occasion.
Like tonight? Yukiko smiled. I know just the thing.
She took his arm and led him past the singing natives, down through a reed-lined valley, across glistening fens, and up to a plateau where a white dome shone with a lamp over the door. Minoru glanced back to see Emil dashing to and fro, joyously recording every aspect of the native celebration. He probably wouldn't be back for hours.